Greetings and salutations. My name is Peter, the big boss at the Hot Sauce, Jerry Blavich, and you're listening to my main man, Rabbi Sol Sullivan, on Dave's Gone By, UNC Radio.
Shalom, hello? Hello, shalom.
Shalom, shalom, shalom. It is such a pleasure for me to be talking to a descendant of the great David, the great Solomon, the great Saul. This is an amazing thing, Rabbi.
I'm also a descendant of the not-so-great Adam and Eve, but there you go. Anywho, that lovely introduction, and I'm letting this man do the introduction for this radio interview because he has done more radio over the years than Dave, more radio probably than Dick Clark and Don Imus put together. His name is Jerry Blavich. Let me tell you a couple of things about this man, who is still, by the way, on the radio today on all these different stations. He has owned record stores. He owns a nightclub. He has managed rock and roll bands. He worked for Don Rickles, for God's sakes. He also was a Philadelphia television show host. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Oh, my God. And most importantly for those people listening now, he has written his autobiography, You Only Rock Once, My Life in Music, which is available from Running Press. And we are running with open arms towards the one, the only, Jerry Blavich. Shalom, Jerry.
Shalom, my man, pots and pans. You are the greatest rabbi in the land. And I got to tell you, for your audience out there, it is such a pleasure for me to talk to you because I can hear the passion that you have and the love that you have for what you do. And if you read my book, may I call you Saul?
Oh, please do.
Okay. If you read the book, Saul, you will find out that I am half Italian and half Jewish.
So which means you're half good. What?
My mother ran away with a Jewish racketeer who she met in the movie, which is in the book. And back in 1936, you did not marry out of your religion. She was Catholic. He was Jewish.
What a shandar.
Yes, she was disowned. And unfortunately, he was in and out of jail. And my mom had to get a job as a riveter during the Second World War. So she had to be at the Navy Yard in Philadelphia by 6 o'clock. And my mom, God bless her, would take me and my sister to a day nursery school called St. Monica's in South Philadelphia. So those were my early years, coming from a broken family. And I used to listen to radio in the loneliness. And I used to listen to some of the great radio serials, The Lone Ranger, Straight Arrow.
My favorite radio serial was Cocoa Puffs, but please continue.
Yes.
I'm sorry, yes.
Straight Arrow, The Lone Ranger, going back with Hopalong Cassidy, and it tweaked my imagination. I was just a kid, lonely. I mean, I couldn't play with the other kids because I had to be up at 5 o'clock to go to a day nursery raised by nuns. And I was intrigued with this great episode of Straight Arrow. It was sponsored by Nabisco, N-A-B-I-S-C-O. Nabisco is the name to know.
Unkosher Nabisco, alas, at that point. We had to eat Hydrox because Nabisco was not kosher. So I know they had a nice commercial, but fat on them. Anywho, continue.
And what happened is I was so intrigued by the Native American Indian, the freedom that they had. They were nomadic. And I envisioned myself, I wanted to be a Native American Indian. I wanted to live my life nomadically. I wanted to be able to be spiritually, because they were great spiritual people. I mean, everything in the world that God created, the Native American appreciated. Unfortunately, we destroyed all of that with the buffalo and giving them alcohol and all that. So I wanted to know everything about the Native American Indian.
But what's odd here is that you're half Italian, half Jewish, and you wanted to be an Indian. I mean, wasn't that just running away from the two cultures that gave you a fairly miserable childhood?
Well, I was looking for something. I was looking for something. And what I found was rock and roll. I was one day at my grandmother's house, and they had a TV show in Philadelphia in 1953 called Bandstand. it was not the Clark's Bandstand. The original guy that had it was a fellow by the name of Bob Horn.
That's right, Bob Horn, yes.
Right, and I saw these kids dancing. And I said to myself, wait a second, I can dance better than that. And I snuck into Bandstand. I was 13 in 1953. You had to be 14 to get in. And I entered a dance contest. I won the dance contest. Fan mail came in. All of a sudden, I'm a teenage star at 13. I get into another dance contest, and I win that contest. The host of Bandstand, Bob Horn, comes to me and said, you know, the only reason that we let you stay, we know that you're underage, is that you won the dance contest, two of them. He said, this is what I would like to do with you. You're such a good dancer, I want you to be the head of the dance committee. I want you to pick the kids that are going to dance in front of the camera, and we're going to rotate them. I want you here. I was going to Southeast Catholic at that time. Bandstand would go on at 3:30 in the afternoon. He said, I want you here at 3 o'clock. I got out of school at 2:15. He said, I want you to also pick records when we rate the records, okay? That you would pick three records and the kids would rate them. Well, that's how it began for me. And now Bob Horn became a second father, the father I never had.
Now, can I ask you, do you remember any records that you picked that went on to be huge smashes and that you feel like you had some play in that?
I could tell you, gigantic hits. I'll give you an example. Fats Domino, Ain't That a Shame, in 1956. Well, Pat Boone had the record on Dot Records. So when Bob gave me Pat Boone's record, I said, Bob, that's not the original. He said, well, the national record guys, Dot Records, gave it to me. I said, no, that's the cover of Fats Domino. He said to me, get me Fats Domino's record. He played the original version. Another record was Shaboom by the Chords. The Crew Cuts had the national hit, but the real hit was by the Chords. The same thing with Long Tall Sally with Little Richard. So I was able, because I always had an ear for music, to pick out rhythm and blues. And all of a sudden, I became a major portion of Bandstand where the promotion men would be coming to me and saying to me, listen to this record. What do you think of this record? And I would say, Bob, I think it's a hit. I think you should play it. Now, remember, I am 15 years old at this point, 16 years old.
Well, that is the demographic for music even today, let's face it. But let me ask you, though. We're talking with Jerry Blavitt here. Was there no issue in the middle of the 1950s on this show in, albeit racially mixed, northern Philadelphia? Wasn't there an issue of not playing Pat Boone and playing the original black artists?
Well, this was the problem, Saul. The major record companies who had national distribution, MGM, Capitol, Dot Records, Mercury, they had national distribution. So when a little local record out of Louisiana called Ain't That a Shame became a gigantic local hit, they didn't have the national distribution. So the majors would cover it, and they would have national distribution. When Dick Clark took over Bandstand, that stopped, because Dick Clark will go on television and play the original version of Sherry, He's So Fine, on little independent record labels, and the majors did not have time to cover it. So it wasn't a racial issue. It was the issue that the little independent labels did not have national distribution.
But once you and Dick Clark started pushing that forward, it became a thing where the little labels got their say and they got as much national exposure on these shows as the big labels did. What were your thoughts on Dick Clark? I'm sure you must have known him. He was Philadelphia.
Listen, Dick Clark wrote the introduction of my book.
Right.
I'll tell you a wonderful story. And it's all in the book. In 1956, Bob Horn lost the show. He had gotten arrested for drunken driving. And I was the head of the committee, and I was told, my duties don't change, you get $15 a week.
Yes.
Bob is not going to be doing the show until the heat dies down. In the interim, they put his producer, Tony Mamarella, as the host. A month goes by, and Tony comes to me and says, look, Bob is not coming back on the show. There's going to be a new host. His name is Dick Clark. I said, Tony, we don't want Dick Clark. I remember, I'm the head of the dance committee. I control all these kids. He said, well, that's it. The day that he did the show, I picketed. We want Bob Horn back. Dick Clark came out with the owners of the station and said to me, look, this show is going to go national. We want you to be the head of the committee. Bob was paying you $15. We're going to give you double $30. We want you to be the head of the committee. I said, no, my loyalty is to Bob Horn. I went back outside, and the pickets continued. The cops come, and they arrest me in 1956. The pickets go down, and all of the kids that danced with me on Bob Horn's bandstand now are national stars on Dick Clark's American Bandstand. Now, it even gets better.
Yeah.
So I am no longer dancing on Bandstand. In the meantime, I knew all of the promotion men from Bandstand, and I'm doing a little bit of promotion for the radio stations, promoting their product with the music that I loved. I find a group called Danny and the Juniors.
Right.
And I have a song which they have called At the Hop, which was produced and written by Johnny Madeira and Dave White locally. Unbeknownst to me, Dick Clark has the publishing of that song. I become the road manager because they are managed by a fellow by the name of Nat Sigel, who eventually will become my manager. I become the road manager of Danny and the Juniors. And we're doing the one-nighters. I'm on the bus with Chuck Berry. I'm on the bus with Little Richard. I'm on the bus with the Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly. I'm on the bus with all of the great rock and roll stars. And you do one-nighter. Philadelphia, New York, Buffalo, Boston. You hit all of these places. We go into New York City to do Dick Clark's Beach Nut Gum Show.
Yes.
You remember that?
I remember his Streit's Matzah Show. But that lasted only 2 weeks. The Beach Nut Gum lasted longer, but I wouldn't watch it in protest. But, okay, so he did
Saturday
this...
Saturday Night Show.
Yeah.
Which featured Bobby Darin, Connie Francis, other than Bandstand. Now, you must remember, this is now 1958. Dick Clark's got the publishing of At the Hop. It is the first time that I see Dick Clark before the rehearsal. He's very cordial. He's very nice. I say to myself, you know, he knows I'm the road manager. He could stop this because I tried to stop him from doing Bandstand.
Right.
We do the show. The next morning, I'm getting on the train at Pennsylvania Station to go back to Philadelphia. Who is on this train? Dick Clark. He says, Jerry, let's sit with me. I want to talk to you as we go back to Philadelphia. And I said, man, this is it. He's going to say, but I didn't say a word. He says, I want to tell you, you tried to stop me from doing the show. We offered you more money. All of these kids now are on a national magazine, Teen Magazine, 16 Magazine. You were the best dancer. He says, yet you wanted to stay with Bob Horn. He says, I got to tell you something. I figured the next line is he's going to fire me. He says, I never had an opportunity to tell you. I respected what you did by staying with Bob. He said, because everybody that kissed his butt and everybody that was giving a piece of this company and that company, I now have on a national scale. I have publishing companies. I've got record companies. And back in that day, Saul,
yes,
there's nothing wrong with disc jockeys owning pieces of record companies. He said, the reason I respect you, I know if I lose Bandstand tomorrow, whoever the new guy comes in, nobody is going to be loyal to me as you were loyal to Bob Horn. We got off that train. It was 1958. I said, Dick, understanding my position. Bob Horn was his second father to me. I lived with him. From that moment on, to the day that Dick Clark died, we remained closest friends. When I went on the radio, and other disc jockeys were knocking the hell out of me because of the fact I came from left field, Dick Clark would say, "Hey, you remember Jerry Blavitt that used to dance locally here? Guess what? He's a disc jockey. He calls himself the Gator with the Heater. I called him last night and he told me to play a song, Sherry," which is true. He said, "I heard him play a song called He's So Fine by the Chiffons. I'm going to play it for you." He heard me play a song called Quarter to Three. So whatever I was playing on radio, Dick would play on Bandstand and would acknowledge the fact that he heard it on my radio show. As a matter of fact,
yes,
in the book, he writes the introduction, which is an amazing introduction. And as you know, he passed away basically 2 years ago, this coming May. And I was out there at the memorial, which was a private memorial at his home in Malibu, with Berry Gordy, with Frankie Valli, with Neil Sedaka, with Paul Anka. Dick Clark did more for rock and roll than any other individual that ever was. Because if it wasn't for Bandstand, Frankie Avalon, Bobby Rydell, Dion, Chubby Checker, Kanye Francis, Bobby Darin would have never had the opportunity to become major stars.
Now, you're mentioning... You're mentioning all these amazing people and people that you rode the bus with that you were talking about before Jerry Blavitt. I want to hear some stories and anecdotes of memories of Chuck Berry, memories of the Everly Brothers, of being on the road with them. Do you have any stories?
Yeah, let me tell you, Sal, remember, we were kids. So the way it would be, the artist would be on a bus. The band orchestra, Sam Donahue, would be on another bus with the producers. The producer was a guy by the name of Irving Feld, who eventually, by the way, became the head of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Circus.
Oh, right.
Feld. His dad was the guy that ran these one-nighters. And we were all kids. In other words, I remember the Everly Brothers in the back of the bus sleeping, and I remember me and Chuck Berry shooting crap, playing dice on a blanket. And I remember the Ponytails, who had a song called Born Too Late, who were beautiful from Cincinnati, and everybody tried to make a move on them, and they had their chaperone. So, you know,
I guess they were born too early. Yeah.
No one knew what the music, that this music was going to be the music that became America, you see. And we would go from one night to sleep on the bus and do our show. And the interesting thing is, these artists today, I'm going to give you an example. When Buddy Holly went on stage and he followed Danny the Juniors, even though we were off, we would stay in the wings and watch him perform and take a little bit of his movement and add it to our show. Back in the day, we were in awe of all of the people that were our peers in rock and roll. Today, these young kids, they don't listen or they don't study. Back then, you studied your profession. When you had to go on at 8 o'clock, you were fined if you were not in your dressing room at 7:30. I mean, it was a wonderful time of show business. And because of, I became Don Rickles' valet. You might remember, that's in the book.
I mentioned that. Now, how on earth did that happen?
Well, in between the time that I was off Bandstand, all right, from 1956, before I found Danny and the Juniors, there was a period of time where I was hanging out with Nat Sigel, who was a booking agent, and he's in the book, that ran nightclubs. He ran Chubby's, the Latin Casino, at a place called the Celebrity Room. And he booked this young comedian out of New York City by the name of Don Rickles. Now, Don Rickles was unknown at that time. And I was with Nat, and Nat said, "Look, he's from New York. He doesn't know Philadelphia. I want you to be his road manager. You pick him up, you take him to the hotel, you you take them to the celebrity room, you make sure they go all the time, blah, 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 blah. We became very, very close friends. Meanwhile, he just completed a motion picture called Run Silent, Run Deep with Burt Lancaster and Mark Cable. Well, when he went back to New York, he went out to L.A. and he worked at a place called the Slate Brothers. The movie opened up, and every major star, Frank Sinatra, Gregory Peck, Sammy Davis, Humphrey Bogart, Lorne Bacall, would go to this little club in L.A. called the Slate Brothers. He became a major star. When he got back to New York City, they had the premiere of Run Silent, Run Deep in Atlantic City. He called me up. He said, look, Fisher, you got to come. You got to be my guest for the premiere in Atlantic City. Also in Atlantic City at the 500 Club was Frank Sinatra. So after the preview, he says to me, Rickles, I want you to meet Frank Sinatra. Now remember, as great as Frank Sinatra was, my stars were Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Fats Domino. Sinatra was not my music.
Okay.
So we go back to the 500, and Rickles says, Mr. S, this is Jerry Blavitt, my road manager. Frank looks at me, and I weigh 115 pounds, and he says, nice to meet you, Matchstick.
Talk about the pot calling the kettle black, though. I mean, he was 118 pounds soaking wet. Did you have other encounters with Frank Sinatra?
Oh, we became dear friends. You know, I was Sammy Davis's best man, if you read in the book.
Was it a Jewish wedding?
I'm sorry.
When was it a Jewish wedding, Sammy Davis Jr.'s wedding?
Not when he married the first time. He married the first time, but was it? It was a Jewish wedding when he married my Brit. That was the second one.
Oh, but the one that you were best man for was a non-Jewish wedding.
This is when he married his third wife, Altabese Gore.
We were
having dinner at my home. He had just finished doing the Mike Douglas show. And he said to me, hey, man, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, what do you need, Sam? He said, you know a judge? I said, whoa, you're not in trouble, Sam. He said, no, I want to marry Altabese. Well, I mean, she was stunned. He didn't even propose to her until that night. And the next day we went to the judge, Judge Gold, and he got married. I flew out to the West Coast. And then Sammy and I, unfortunately, he passed away May the 16th, 1990, and I was there. I zipped him up in the bag.
Oh, my God, wait a minute. You were at his bedside, in other words.
I was at his bedside. What happened is, I would fly in and out of Philly to California. He was at Cedars Mount Sinai. And they finally sent him home, and I got a call from Shirley Rose, his manager, and said, you better get out of here right away. He's not going to make it for the weekend. I lived next to Carmel Kroll, who was my neighbor. I had a big 22-room estate. And I went over to see the Cardinal. I said, Cardinal, my friend Sammy Davis is dying. He said, listen, I'm going to give you some holy water from Lourdes. You put this on his forehead. I went out with holy water from Lourdes on a Thursday. And Thursday night, anoint him. All right. They would take the bandage off, and you could actually see where the cancer ate through. And they would wrap him with the holy water. Saw he was off life support. All right. All life support. His heart was beating. Okay.
Yes.
He lasted Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. On a Wednesday, May the 16th, that Tuesday night, I said, I got to get back to Philadelphia. The doctors, because he was off life support, said it's a miracle that he is still alive, but his heart was so strong. I got ready to go back to Philadelphia the morning of May the 16th at 7:45. I went into his room, and I noticed that the heart monitor had stopped, the little urine thing that, you know, that they had stopped, and he had passed. That was May the 16th, 1990.
My God. I guess he waited until he knew you couldn't stay anymore. You had to go back to Philadelphia, so that's when, boom, he died. I know I have my urine bag going all the time. It'll go 2 weeks after I die, that's for sure. We're talking with Jerry Blavitt, who is the author of You Only Rock Once, My Life in Music. Do you have any Sinatra stories?
Great stories about Frank. You know, Frank, let me tell you the difference between Sammy, Frank, and Dean. Sammy was so approachable. We'd be walking down the street. Guys say, hey, Geeter, hey, Sammy. And we, yo, my man, pots and pans and all that. Frank, when he would walk down the street, he would have the bodyguards, Jimmy. And people who really wanted to say hello were a little afraid, not knowing what his reaction would be. Frank was, in my opinion, one of the greatest talents, but Sammy Davis was the greatest talent of them all and a magnificent human being. Frank, without a doubt, was complex, generous, could change his moods momentarily, and I could understand that. See, because I lived with these people. I saw when they were successful, when they were maybe not successful, and how they became affected. Frank was the greatest. He loved my mother's cooking. Whenever he was in town, and this is all in the book, my mother was Bruzzese Napolitan. So he'd say, Matchstick, I need the peppers and the eggs your mother makes. I need the raviolis. Because you see, Frank was Sicilian. And his mom, Dolly, was a great cook. But the greatest cooks from Italy were the ones that came from Abruzzi. So he would go out with me at night. And we would have my mother's cooking. And I will never forget a story which I want your audience to hear.
Please.
In the latter years when Frank was failing, you know, he couldn't see the teleprompter. He had to wear an earpiece. We were in New York, Sammy, myself, and Jilly, 2 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, a place called Rocky Lee's. And Frank was very solemn. And we tried to get him out of that mood, and we were talking about guys in show business at that time, Johnny Carson, who told a funny joke, all of a sudden, Frank said, everybody grew silent. He said, you know, these guys in show business, they don't understand how lucky they are to be able to perform for an audience. The day that I stop performing and see those wonderful people who love me is the day that I die. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he went into the hospital, all kinds of medical problems, and he died. Which is what a performer lives for us all. I've been doing this for 54 years. I bucked the trend. I play music from a heart, not a research chart. I never allowed anyone to take away my freedom to play music for the audience that I love. I was able to expose records when nobody was able, because back then, radio became formatted. Radio didn't play any more records because of the English invasion. Everything was English, English, English.
Well, how did you survive the British invasion, you know, the Beatles coming in, the Stones, which is the music that I prefer, actually.
How I survived is because I was on a station that gave me the freedom to pick my own music. No one ever dictated to me. I never played English. And I'll tell you a very interesting story. Do you know during the English invasion, when every radio station was playing nothing but English, Herman's Hermits, the Beatles, Freddie Mann, I mean, on and on and on, the Dave Clark Five, I was playing Motown, the Four Seasons, and the Beach Boys, and Rhythm and Blues. Those three groups are the only ones that survived. And look where they are today. Motown, Frankie Valli's Four Seasons, Rhythm and Blues, okay, and the Beach Boys. They are still as popular today. Tell me the English groups today that broke up, okay, that are not still around. American music was rock and roll.
Well, all right. I think we sort of differ. I think the Rolling Stones are doing a little bit better than the Beach Boys, than Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Wait, the Rolling Stones, I don't consider. I consider the Rolling Stones to be more rhythm and blues, black rock and roll.
They would say that too, you know.
I mean, the Rolling Stones represent rock and roll, American rock and roll, which is international around the world, you know. But those other English groups, man, where are they?
Oh, I see. Well, you know, they broke up, but they became legends that are still... Well, what I'm as much as there's much to love about the music that you play and that early R&B, and certainly that great 1950s Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, but people might confuse maybe a little what you do with the doo-wop era. And you don't do that so much, do you?
I do. I created that. When I went on the radio in the book, I was doing a nightclub act. And you got to get the book. For your listeners, I must tell you as a listener, this book is not about my life. This book is about America. When America was young and free, and you were able, if you found a dream, to go for the dream, if you were able to find a passion, to go for that passion. You were reading the book, man. I defied. Even to this day, I play music from my heart. If I like it, I want to share it with my audience. I don't go to a program director. I don't go to a research marketing guy. That's baloney. When I grew up in America, you had the freedom. You didn't learn from a book. You will see in my book, you will learn the way my life was. I learned from living, from a broken family, from sadness to happiness to fulfillment. Today in America, it's restricted. This, that. You can't do that. You can't do that. I grew up with dignity. I grew up with respect because I learned it from the street. I learned it from my father, who was a racketeer, and I learned the love from my mother. And that's why this book is a bestseller. I mean, it just keeps on selling.
By the way, the name of the book is You Only Rock Once, My Life in Music by Jerry Blavick. I do think the irony there is that you're half Italian, half Jewish, and the Jewish side was the racketeer and the mobster, which is pretty funny. You know, one would assume it would be the other way around. But you did, I mean, we cannot also get away from this, that you did have, oh boy, friendships and connections with people in the underworld through most of your professional life that you swear up and down were just friends, and yet other people will say, well, no, you could not have been so blind, or just like high-waving, having dinner, and then going home and not knowing what the hell some serious mafia mobsters were doing.
Right. Let me say this to you. I have never denied my friendship with any of these people. I grew up in South Philadelphia. My neighbor was Angelo Bruno. His wife grew up in the same town in Italy as my mother. We were paisans. I knew all of these guys. You never asked about their business. You never saw them do anything wrong. They were neighbors. And when I became successful, and I must tell you, even with Frank, where they said that these guys helped Frank, I can honestly tell you, Frank's talent helped Frank Sinatra. These guys owned the nightclubs back then, so you worked for these guys at that time. But if you were not able to bring an audience in, I don't care if you were Frank Costello's brother. They would not use you. They were businessmen. My friendship, and I have never denied anybody, if you're my friend and you live next door to me and you're a neighbor, as long as you don't do anything wrong in front of me, you are my friend. And that's the way I base my life. I don't judge a person by the money that they have. I don't judge by the prestige. I judge them the way they are to me and the neighbors in the neighborhood.
I'm just kind of also wondering, though, like you witnessed the death of Sammy Davis Jr. You were a friend. You saw him die and that morning. Okay, that's one way of watching a person die. You were in a restaurant during a rub out. What the hell? Didn't that traumatize you?
Well, you got to understand something. When you're involved in a situation like that, and it's in the book, this thing happened so fast. And I really wasn't even supposed to be there. You'll read in the book that Long John Martorano, who was a mobster, was in the vending business. And when Angelo Bruno died, and the family came to me and said to me, look, you're almost like a second son, because when my wife and I split, I used to take Angelo's grandkids, along with my kids, every Sunday to dinner. So one Sunday, I'm dropping off Angelo's grandkids, and Sue Bruno said to me, wait, you and Patty split? I said, well, we've got some differences. It's in the book. She said, well, where do you eat in the morning? Well, I had a 22-room estate. All of a sudden, I'm living in a one-room place called the Drake Hotel in Center City. I said, well, she said, look, come over in the morning. You'll have breakfast with us. You'll have dinner with us. And when I split with my wife, I became a second partner of that family. I'm talking about I was almost like adopted by Sue, by the kids, the grandkids. And when he was murdered, he came to me and said, look, you're like a son to us. Please, at this funeral, don't make it be a circus. You know the press. You know the guy, law enforcement guys that have been following Angelo. I said to myself, if I do this, I am going to expose myself to the newspapers and to law enforcement. How a guy like Jerry Blavin, in show business, is now the man keeping out the press, law enforcement, making sure there are no pictures taken. But I said to myself, this family adopted me when I lost my family. I said to Sue and Michael Bruno, Angie's son, I'll do it. Sure enough, if you read the book, for 10 years, I was under the scrutiny of law enforcement. As a matter of fact, in the book you will read the head of the FBI, I was having lunch, and he's in there having lunch. And he sees me, and he waves me over. And I go to the bar, and I said, yes, I knew his name. Okay, he was the head of the FBI. He said, how do you know who I am? I said, I once did a TV show, and the topic was on organized crime, and you were there, Angelo's lawyer was there, and I had to drive Angelo's lawyer. He said, oh, I remember that. He said, but I'm going to tell you why I invited you to come over for a moment. He said, what you did for that family was admirable. He said, Angelo Bruno was also a friend of ours. Because he kept the lid down. There was no killings, there was no drugs at that time. He said, but there's going to be a lot of questions why you were so close to that family. So for 10 years later, I had clubs. They investigated how I got the money, and they found out that I've always been my own man. I've worked every day of my life.
I am kind of also curious. I mean, I have a very, very minor life in radio. You have had a major life in radio. You managed Danny and the Juniors. You did other jobs. But where did 22-room mansions come from? Was it from radio money? How did you make a real killing?
You got to understand. I was doing, in the 60s, record hops in Philadelphia with 2,000 kids. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I was making, back then, $125,000 a year. Back then,
that's right.
63.
And that buys a mansion pretty quickly in 63, right?
Right, and then when I went on TV in 1965, we had a national syndicated TV show. I was making $200,000 in the 60s.
Give up.
I'm a performer, Saul. I am a performer. I am an entertainer. I am not a disc jockey. To this very day, I'm on the air every day, 7 days a week, and I work 4 days doing shows.
Good
Lord. I
worked
at Putty Forge Casino. I mean, I've always made money. Remember, you make money. Money does not make the man. Remember that.
It certainly hasn't made me, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Wow. By the way, we're talking with Jerry Blavitt. He is, yes, and if people wanted to listen to you, not out in the New York or New Jersey area, how can they, the best way to listen to you on the radio every day?
Well, we're on the Internet. Carol, how do they get us on the Internet?
The radio show?
Yeah, the radio show, yeah.
WBLT?
Yeah, WBLT.com.
VLT.com.
WVLT.com. We're also on a wonderful station on Saturday nights, the University of Pennsylvania, WXPN.org.
WXPN.org. And you're still playing the music that you grew up with, that you promoted, that you love from that era. Do you play any new music at all in that style?
Absolutely. Listen, let me tell you something about music. Music has no bounds. If something is good, whether it was cut today or whether it was cut in 1940 with Cole Porter, if it's good, it's good. When I hear something that I like, whether it's yesterday or today, and it has a lyric, and it has a beat, and it's not derogatory, where it's not knocking law enforcement, it's not degrading a woman, it's not talking about shooting somebody, I don't do that, man. I play music that tells a story about love and life. And I dance. I'm still a dancer.
What is your favorite song of all time?
Oh, my God. There are so many. The Impossible Dream.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
Yeah.
The Impossible Dream from Man of La Mancha. That's interesting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And great versions. Jack Jones had one. But my favorite all-time version is by The Temptations in a Mellow Mood album.
I'm going to have to find that and play that for the end of the interview. We have a couple more minutes here with Jerry Blavitt, the author of You Only Rock Once. A couple of other people. I want to hear more stories about the people that you knew over the years. You were on an episode of The Monkees. Which one? And what the hell was that? Must have been an acid scene. What was it?
Well, it was called Some Like It Lukewarm. And at that time, my TV show was in L.A., 1968, which major success. I mean, we were in 40 different stations. And the producer of The Monkees saw my TV show and wanted to be for one of the episodes. So I went out there with Sammy Dale. I lived with Sammy a period of time in L.A., and I met the producer. He said, look, you're perfect for the part. He said, the guy's name is Parker, not Jerry Blavitt. He said, I'm going to send you the script. I had to go back to Philadelphia. They sent me the script. I read the script. As I get off the plane, they're there with a limo, and they're rushing me. They say, look, we're already in the production. You got to get here right away. They throw me on the set, and all of a sudden, I said, I know my lines. I start to ad-lib them. And instead of me calling myself Perry Parker, I say, this is the gig of the big boss with the hot sauce. The director says, cut. He says, I like that. Keep right on going. So all of a sudden, the Geeter was no longer Perry Parker. I was doing what I do all the time. And because of that, Sammy did a Mod Squad.
Oh.
And I did a Mod Squad episode with him. I played a driver for him, and he played a hitman in a Mod Squad, you see.
By the way, where did the Geeter with the heater come from?
That is from Alligator Lives in the Mud, Geeter, Gator. They don't bother anybody. But if you get that close to an alligator, he's going to snatch you up. When I went on radio, I was only at the other end of the dial. I was on a 250-watt station. The other rock and roll station was 50,000 watts. But yet, at night, my phones were lighting off the turntables. So I said, this is crazy. I just can't be Jerry Blavitt. So I said, what makes sense? An alligator. Alligator? Geeter? They don't bother you. I'm not bothering these people, but I'm snatching them up. So I became the geeter. What goes with heater? Geeter, meter, reader? No. a car heater. You're on the corner with the guys. It's freezing in South Philly. The guy comes by in a car. We jump in the guy's car. We say, turn the heat up. After 10 minutes, it's so hot, you say, turn the heater down. I became the geeter with the heater. The heater being the old record pleater, the rock and roll music. And the parents in the background with the dedications are saying, turn that guy down. He's raucous. He's too loud. So I became the geeter with the heater.
Oh, that's a fabulous story for Jerry Blabbitt, the author of You Only Rock Once, My Life in Music, from Running Press. The question also to kind of end this interview is, how long are you going to keep doing what you're doing? You've got to be in your 70s at this point.
Listen, as long as God gives me the strength, and as long as I love what I do, I'm not a phony. I do it. I love my audience. The day that I lose my passion for what I do, and I'm not in good health, I stop. And it's interesting because you see the book? It is a bestseller. Time Magazine, New York Post said, required reading, a remarkable journey. And it is. And, you know, it's available online. People can get it online at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, you know. But I love what I do. I'm blessed. I'm one of the few people in America where America did not change my beliefs, my passion, and the love that I have for my audience.
And also, when can people see the next show that you put together as far as you do a couple of shows a year at the Kimmel?
You know, I do these wonderful cruises for Time Life called Malt Shop Memories Cruise. And we have every major star. Last show, we had Bobby Rydell, you had Dion, you had Frankie Avalon, you had Gary Lewis, you had Petula Clark. I mean, every major star is on the show. We're doing another one in November, and I'm doing a big show at the Kimmel Center in Philadelphia, January the 25th, called the Great Voices of the 60s. Jay Black, Gary U.S. Bonds, Bobby Rydell, The Tokens, Eddie Holman, Pat Upton of the Spiral Staircase.
Can I ask, when you do these shows, are you seeing a mix in audiences, or is it almost all like 70-plus?
Absolutely. You must understand, when a young person hears Run Around Sue for the first time, the reaction is the same that you did when you heard it when you were a kid. It's a good record. So these young people are intrigued when they hear this music for the first time. That's how I started the radio. I was doing a nightclub act. When the snowstorm closed the club, I had to take my old rock and roll records to the studio where I did the show. And I started to play music, which were oldies. Kids were surfing the dial because they didn't know if they were going to have off from school the next day. And they heard the music of the 50s. And they loved it because nobody was playing it at that time.
Right. You'll give some variety to everything else that's on the radio.
Absolutely.
And one more quick question. I am curious, how long did it take you to develop your, you don't want to be called a disc jockey, but the way that your persona is on the air?
It happened from the first moment that I started to play rock and roll. I mean, I ad-lib. I mean, you want to talk about me rapping. I mean, people say the Geeter was the first rapper. Don't be ashamed, mention my name, don't holler. Listen to the Geeter, it's not going to cost you a dollar. By the big TikTok on the Tower Power Park. Here we go with the hottest show on the radio. So, you know, I rhymed all this stuff.
Can you close with a rhyme about me?
About you?
Yes.
Take a tip from the geek with the heat. Saul the Phonic Saul is the man who's the five finest rabbi in the land.
Thank you, Jerry Blabbitt. That was wonderful. It's been a delight talking to you. I've read part of your book. I haven't had time to read the rest of it, but I will, because it's a tremendous story. It is, as you said, a bestseller for Running Press. It's called You Only Rock Once, My Life in Music. May you have many more years in life and music, Jerry Blabbitt. Thank you so much.
Thank you.